Thanks very much, Geoff. So there's, as you've heard, a fairly interesting set of papers today. So the Chair asked us not only to comment on the papers today, but also talk about a few things which haven't been covered and which might potentially be covered in the future. So I'll do a bit of both. So looking, I mean, there's one, I thought there was basically one common theme across four of the five papers today, which is very much, which were very much around cross-border flows, which I think is one issue which has been very much highlighted with our experience, or the experience of the last 6 or 7 years. Ross's paper was very much about how to get money across borders, small amounts of money potentially across borders, but still nevertheless about cross-border flows and flows within regions. Justin, Eliza's and Jenny's were very much, much more explicitly on the issue of cross-border flows. And as I said, this, that has become a much more prevalent issue in the research agenda generally over the last few years. In part, it's also been enabled by the fact that we actually have a bit more data on this than we used to have, which makes some of the exercises like we saw from Eliza earlier at least possible in a way that wasn't possible even 10 years ago. And so I think the fact that those papers are focusing on that issue, I think, is good. Let me talk in a little bit of detail, a little more detail about a couple of things in Eliza's paper. And this was highlighted in at least one or two of the questions. And I think one thing which you have to be careful about, I think, in this area is the fact that there's a lot of stuff going on at the same time. And correlation doesn't imply causation. The identification problem, I think, is quite problematic in this sort of exercise, and so I think one has to be particularly careful about that and in whether the data sets is better, as I said, they're better than they were 10 years ago. Whether they allow you to fully get to that is not entirely clear. The other thing which I think is important in the work that Eliza did is also that gross flows matter, not net flows. So a lot of the focus traditionally in macro, at least, or in macro finance has been on net flows. But actually, what the experience of the last few years shows is that the gross flows matter at least as much, or probably more so, than the net flows. So I think the issue of... the other point which I think came out in Eliza's work, which is relevant, is, and it was actually clear in her presentation... the question is whether this is an issue for Europe, and it's or whether this is an issue for the world. And because of the sample size she chose, it was overweight Europe. Many things are overweight Europe, including international meetings. But in her data, is particularly overweight Europe. And it's not entirely clear whether the conclusions you're getting from that are about Europe or they're actually about the rest of the world more generally. And it's, for instance, the sovereign debt issue. Because of the fact that the European banks are in the euro area and that up until at least reasonably recently, only a few years back, all sovereign debt was treated exactly the same way by the ECB, then there was an obvious incentive for cross-border flows within Europe to occur where a French bank would load up on Greek paper in a way that isn't true for a bank coming from outside that region. So I think in doing the analysis, you've got to be careful about what's true for Europe and what's true for the world as a whole. I found Jenny's paper interesting. As I said, everyone talks a lot about regional financial integration. Jenny's been talking about regional financial integration for a very long time. And I think it's interesting now that the project, one of the purposes of this exercise is to work out exactly what we mean by regional financial integration. The one thing which slightly disturbed me about Jenny's paper was the need for more regional meetings, because best as I can tell, I already go to more than my fair share of them, and I don't think I have enough time in my calendar to fit any more in. If, however, Jenny, and I think this is what she was actually more talking about, was more productive regional meetings, then that's obviously, I would very much be in favour of that, but more, no, definitely not. And in fact, one interesting structure which has evolved in part dealing with the issues that Jenny raised is if you look at the Financial Stability Board, now it's very much a group of regulators across the sort of dimensions that Jenny was talking about. Only, I think, in the last year, 18 months or so, have they started turning that into much more regional focus or regional outreach. So that's a fairly new development doesn't necessarily mean there's not scope for further improvement, but it's something which has actually evolved only very recently. And in fact, the wider membership of the FSB is itself actually not all that old at this stage, and it's still probably a bit of a work in progress. But as I said, I think the focus of those papers, of the papers we saw today on in terms of cross-border flows, is very much a part of the research agenda globally, which I think is one which can be, there's a lot of useful insights to be gained. I've missed out Stephen's paper. I actually found Stephen's paper very interesting, but as an accountant, I don't have anything. I'm not an accountant. I don't have any great insights, but I did like the way the paper was actually set up. I've come across a slightly different, and the execution of it as well. I think it's interesting if you come across a couple of similar. I mean, the role of accounting in what's happened over the last few years, over the past 6 or 7 years, I think is also somewhat underappreciated. If you look at the way, for instance, a lot of accounting around the valuation of securities happened through this period, that had actually a material impact on the way the financial system actually functioned. And there's, including, for instance, what gets put in the trading book and what gets put in the banking book, had a material impact on the perceived, at least, viability of various financial institutions. So while accounting may sometimes seem like an esoteric exercise, I think for a number of reasons, and including the one that Stephen highlighted in his paper, it's not. Another initiative, at least very much on the banking side of things, is part of the Basel liquidity standards, and something which is potentially something underappreciated, of the new Basel standards, is there's a focus on executive remuneration. Now, Stephen very much highlighted something that if you tie executive remuneration to something that they themselves have an influence on the way it's actually presented, that is problematic, and that's something which has been grappled with in the financial sector as well. So having talked a little bit about what these papers today did, let me just talk about a couple of issues where I think there is plenty of scope for more work. And the first one is that basically, this is coming more from a macro point of view as much as a financial point of view, but finance, broadly speaking, was neglected in macro. It was just assumed to be there, and it broadly was assumed to function. Obviously, the last few years demonstrate that's not true. And it also was very much assumed to be a veil, and how exactly it actually happened didn't really matter. And I think we know now that that's not true. The way the financial system actually functions does matter. So the papers today focus on the way that finance flows across borders actually matters. So just saying finance flows across borders isn't actually enough. You need to dig in and find out more about the way that it actually flows across borders. More generally, I think there's been an underappreciation and an under-investigation from the academic community of the plumbing of the financial system. It's just assumed to be there. Not many people actually have a good understanding of how it actually works, but it actually really does matter. And so one area where I think that plenty more scope for work is on the plumbing of the financial system, the way that money actually flows, the way parts, what happens in one part of the system is transmitted to other parts of the system. One area which is very much in focus, at least on the sort of regulatory stuff that I'm involved in, is collateral. So macro models don't even know, collateral is irrelevant in macro models. Even in macro finance models, collateral is basically irrelevant. But you can make a reasonable argument that collateral is not necessarily as important as money, but it's not a hell of a long way behind. Eliza sort of picks up in that a little bit because she's looking at sovereign debt holdings of banks, and sovereign debt is one of the primary forms of collateral. But I think that's one area which has been underappreciated. A lot of the financial regulation coming down the pipe or in train at the moment is going to make a lot of demands or require banks to hold, or financial institutions to hold, a lot more collateral than they did previously. The question is, how is that all going to work, or indeed even if it's going to work at all? So that's one area where I think there's plenty more scope for work. When you talk about collateral, then you start talking about things like network effects. And so Jenny showed a nice picture of network effects in terms of cross-border banking flows. I think there is a lot of work in its infancy now on sort of networks effects of financial systems, bringing in insights from biology and the like. And I think that's another area where I think there's plenty more scope for further work. The final thing I would just throw out there, which partly follows on from the first two, is if you just look at the size of the financial sector, one can ask the question as to whether the financial sector needs to be that size. In some countries, you can argue whether the financial sector is as big as it needs to be. In the other countries, you can ask whether the financial sector is too big. If you look at the financial sector's share in the gross operating surplus, value added, for want of a better term, in Australia, it's large. One could ask a reasonable question as whether it's too large. So, again, I think that's another question which can potentially be put out there. The financial sector, particularly in G10 countries, has grown dramatically over the last two decades or so. Is that appropriate? Again, that's a question which is starting to be asked in different places around the world, but another area where I think there's further scope for research. So, briefly to sum up, I think the fact that a lot of the papers today focused on cross-border flows is very pleasing to see, because I think that's something, an area where there needs to be plenty of research done, and it's pleasing to see that it is actually being done as part of this process. But I said, if I throw out a couple of other areas where there's plenty of scope for future work, one is very much about bringing finance into macro and not just assuming that it's there and that it functions, and including digging into the sort of plumbing of the financial system. And as I said, finally, looking at the issue of how large a financial sector does an economy actually need. Let me finish there.
Hi, Kingsley Jones, Jevons Global. My question is for Guy, with the bell. You mentioned the cross-border flows, and I think you gave some emphasis to that, and also how gross flows, in your opinion, are more important than net. In the context of some of the presentations, particularly the ones that are talking about new methods of data analysis like network analysis, what insights might you offer on your experience of knowing the plumbing on data sources that may be available but aren't being used? That'd be really interesting.
Yeah, Eliza's using one of them, and in fact it was in Jenny's paper as well. So the BIS banking statistics really developed a lot over the last few years. So there's a lot more information. There's a lot of information. A number of people aren't aware there's a lot of information which isn't in those statistics. You actually have to be very careful in asserting what exactly they're about. For instance, broadly speaking, there's no derivative transactions in there. And the way they measure some of the banking flows in terms of identifying which jurisdiction they're actually coming out of, there's some issues around that. As best as I can tell, there's only one person in the world who gets anywhere close to fully understanding that, who's the guy, the biz, who puts it together, who Eliza actually knows. But I'm not entirely sure that he fully appreciates it all the time. But so that's one very fertile ground. There's potentially a fair bit more coming down the pipe. With requirements that trades are reported in trade repositories, there's potentially going to be a lot of data. Now, who gets access to what chunk of that data is still very much an open question. But as I said, going forward, there's potentially going to be a lot more data to work with than there has been historically. Beyond that, it's actually really a fairly painful effort exercise of going in and digging around jurisdiction by jurisdiction, really. And then you get issues of how compatible they are across jurisdictions. There's a large project underway which has got a number of global institutions in it, between the IMF, the BI, and the BIS at least. I'm not sure I'll get this exactly right, but basically it's the Data Gap Initiative, which identifies that indeed there's a lot of data gaps. We have a much better sense, at least, of what the gaps are now than we did previously. And so there's a process in trying to try and address some of those data gaps. How long that process will actually take to bear fruit, I don't know. But so I'm not sure I can point you to anything outside the the banking statistics. And I said the only thing I'd say around the banking statistics, you need to be careful in understanding what's in those data and what's not.
There's been a Ross Clare, Association of Superannuation Funds of Australia. There's been mention of the gross and net cross-border flows. An issue that has been a topic of some discussion is the flows overseas from superannuation funds, and on the other side, banks relying on inflows of debt finance to help with their operations. I was just wondering if any of the panelists was game enough to provide some commentary on that. Is it good, bad? Doesn't really matter. Will be covered off in submissions to the Financial Systems Inquiry. But it is a topic of particular interest to the superannuation sector, and I think the banking sector, and would be very interested in any perspectives any of the panellists could bring to that topic.
Look, it's clearly when the commentariat talk about the Financial System Inquiry, and they talk about, they waffle on about superannuation and the banking system and this funding the economy thing, the issue really is that the, in very broad terms, the superannuation system possibly has about the lending capacity of another big Aussie bank sitting in it at the moment, and the mentality, the plumbing and wiring and the skills that are needed to apply that money to funding small businesses and indeed even home buyers and major businesses just doesn't seem to be there. And so you've got a very intellectually stimulating series of very sort of big issues, the demographic shifts that are happening, the fact that we don't have a non-bank domestic corporate bond market, all of these pieces all go together into a, you know, a very chunky piece of work for the Financial System Inquiry to work out what levers have to be pushed, what could the government do, if anything, to reorient the, at least in part, the thinking of the superannuation system, that it does have a role here. It needs to be gathering the sorts of assets that back not sexy equity-style returns in accumulation, but the long-term promises that are going to be owed to people in retirement that want inflation-adjusted regular cash flows in order to replace their working paychecks with something in retirement. So all of these issues are pretty weighty, as is the need for viable infrastructure projects to be properly funded, et cetera. And it is an interesting issue that, you know, while the, and I don't want to talk over Guy's space here, but, you know, while the reliance on wholesale funding has
use,
certainly...
sorry is the word. You don't rely on it, you use it. So.
Yeah. And yet the superannuation system seems to be, will have to export and is exporting considerable amounts of capital to find homes for that. So look, these are most definitely issues that I would think the Financial System Inquiry will look at.
And I think it's interesting. You know, if you're in a global financial system and they're going to be cross-border flows, someone's got to be doing them. So I always find it saying, well, you know, we don't like these cross-border flows. Well, if you want to be in a global financial system, that and if you want to have portfolio diversification and cross-border portfolio diversification, well, guess what? Someone's actually got to do that. So you are going to see financial flows. Now, you can argue whether that structure is right or not, or exactly appropriately configured, that's for sure, but there are going to be cross-border flows. And as I said, part of the issue about looking at gross flows, you see that flows go in both directions. But if you, as I said, if we are in a global financial system, there will be cross-border flows between different, with different intermediaries doing that intermediation. And, you know, that's the world you've basically signed yourself up to.
And if I may venture a comment on the end of that, the answer just may be, well, what's efficient? It may be that superannuation funds are very good at making equity-style investments and are not good at making loans. Banks are good at borrowing money offshore and onshore and on lending it. And if that is functioning efficiently, it's fine, and there's we don't have to have patriotic based distortions of funding, general considerations of prudence for the banking sector come into play. Are you excessively dependent on overseas funding or short term funding or the like? But that's been managed for a long time.
Good afternoon, James Wall from the Commonwealth Bank. Probably just touching on, I guess, the non-bank lending sector, potentially. Is any of this sort of... We looked at Eliza's paper that looked at bank flows and the influences of the regulatory environment skewing towards investment-grade sovereign debt. Are you seeing, or are you in the data shop, what non-bank lenders are doing in this space, and is that becoming an influence in any of the data you're observing? I think your comment before was that combined superannuation is about the size of one major bank, but is that globally an influence now in the flows we're seeing, and is it something the regulators are looking at?
Who would like to
So there's a whole chunk of stuff on shadow banking. Shadow banking, interestingly, basically only exists in two countries, which is in the US and in China, most popularly at the moment, at least. So if you want it, however you want to define, leaving aside Jeremy's super question, which is important, but at least the way the rest of the world thinks about shadow banking, it doesn't really exist outside the US and China. So the question you ask is no, because it doesn't exist outside the US and China. And the Chinese stuff is all within China, and the US shadow banking sector doesn't do a lot of cross-border stuff either. But then I think the question is, how do you think about... the superannuation industry is an intermediary, right? Mm-hmm. It's taking in people's money and investing it in something. It's no different conceptually as an intermediary as the banking system is. But as Jeremy says, it does intermediate in an incredibly different way than the banking sector does. So does that mean it needs to start heading down some of these other lines? As you said, I think that's an important question to think about. From the sort of stuff I look at, if you think about liquidity management, which we spent a hell of a lot of time thinking about that for the banking system, but up until fairly recently, the superannuation system hadn't thought about liquidity management at all, because if you're in accumulation mode, it's irrelevant.
Yes.
When you start moving into a more mature mode that you're talking about, then liquidity management becomes much more of a first-order issue. And the banking system's had plenty of experience, might not have learned from that experience, but has had plenty of experience with liquidity management over a few centuries. But that's something which is only really just entering the psyche of superannuation sector now.
That's a really good point. I think sometime over the next decade, and maybe again this is something the inquiry can look at, is just doing a little tweak to, and again this is a bit of a nudge, but basically saying to the super system, okay, well you guys ought to be thinking about getting the sorts of assets that you can repo to the reverse repo to the RBA, and we're going to, because that's effectively a borrowing transaction, the super funds aren't allowed to do that at the moment. And so you'd open up that pathway, and that would again incentivize banks to hold assets that they don't really hold that much of, so that they would then be able to tap the sort of liquidity that ADIs can tap. So that would have a dual that it probably would do something positive for the system in easing that liquidity pressure, but it would also force super funds to hold some of those sorts of assets. So again, that could be something that the inquiry could look at.